Welcome to the archives of The Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. We've all lived, mankind, humankind has lived with the extraordinary, the PSI, that's the PSI abilities of our mind, of our being for millennia. It's only recently, though, that it really has become more mainstream. And how has this field changed and become accepted? What breakthroughs have we seen in the last several decades? Well, we've invited Charles Tart to join us tonight to answer that question and to tell us about his own adventures in 40-some years of investigating consciousness and altered states. As a parapsychologist, he's been at this for a long, long time. He's written Mind Science, Meditation Training for Practical People, and Open Mind, Discriminating Mind, Reflections on Human Possibilities, as well as States of Consciousness. He joins us from Berkeley, California. Charles, hello.
Good evening, Loralee.
How are you tonight?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm looking forward to a good show.
Me too. Boy, you were defining parapsychologist, which is a term that you use for yourself, and we were discussing how parapsychology is the study of anything that's beyond the norm. This is fun territory.
Right, but you're also getting into the part that I'm ambivalent about. I seldom define myself as a parapsychologist, actually. I define myself as a psychologist, one of whose interests is parapsychology.
Ah, okay.
And the reason is that while, you know, I and a few other people have worked very hard to bring a scientific approach to this, there are a lot of people with no scientific training who pretend to have it and who mix in all sorts of weird stuff. So, you know, it's like there is important and unusual stuff out there that makes a difference in the way we live, and there's also a lot of nonsense out there, and we need to discriminate them somehow. Believing nonsense isn't good for us.
Give me a list of some of the top two or three things in the weird stuff that's flaky and the weird stuff that has merit and is important for us to understand about how our mind works and what our capabilities really are.
Well, being an optimist, let's start at the merit end of things first. For instance, we live in a time when people think that science is pretty much disproven religion, that it's all a lot of nonsense. So from this conventional mainstream view, since there are no spirits or gods or anything like that, if you say a prayer, what are you doing? You're talking to yourself. Maybe aloud, maybe just in your mind, but that's all you're doing. You're talking to yourself. Now along comes the evidence from parapsychology, where we show that under the best kinds of strict laboratory conditions, people are sometimes telepathic. That is, sometimes, in spite of the limitations of the physical world, one mind can reach out and convey information to another. Well, now, wait a minute. Is prayer necessarily such a nonsensical thing, then? If one human mind can sometimes transcend the physical and reach out to another, well, maybe prayer is not such a nonsensical idea. Maybe it bears looking at.
I think that there has been a lot of looking at prayer, and there's been thousands of studies documenting its efficacy.
I'd say a couple of dozen studies at the most. And most mainstream scientists don't bother to read those studies because they know they can't possibly be right.
But isn't that the role of science, to demonstrate what is or isn't right?
Yeah, but you have to realize that scientists are human beings, just like everybody else. We have our prejudices, we have our hopes and fears, and we might be pretty good within our specialty, but we get arrogant and think we know everything, just like people in all walks of life do. So you have a lot of scientists who are prominent skeptics. I think of them as pseudo-skeptics, actually. I mean, I admire a real skeptic. I mean, a real skeptic is somebody who's interested in the truth but not satisfied with conventional explanations, so they're still looking. Mm-hmm. That's an honorable position. The pseudo-skeptics say that's what things are, but in point of fact, they know the truth, namely that anything psychic or spiritual is pure nonsense and they're out to debunk it. So they don't bother to read these experimental studies. They know they've got to be wrong beforehand. That's a hard mindset to overcome.
You must have seen some colleagues in the field who've been confronted by that very prejudiced, though they thought it was right. And what happens to the majority of them? Do they get struck by lightning and then it's overcome because of their own experience? Or do they carry on and, as can be so common in life, you prove to yourself your own conclusions merely by the way that you take in information and what you selectively listen to and experience?
That's right. I have high standards of proof for things I don't want to believe, but I'll kind of casually accept things I want
to. We all have our blind spots,
and
don't we?
I watch that in myself. See, I have this old-fashioned idea that science is really kind of a noble quest. I'm interested in truth, whatever the truth really is, regardless of what I want it to be. So I know that I'm very biased, for instance. So when I do a scientific experiment, part of doing that is to figure out what are my biases, what are the subtle ways I might sort of load the dice to make things come out the way I'd prefer. And okay, I'll acknowledge that, but I really have an interest in what the truth actually is. So how can I get around those biases?
How can you get out of your own way?
Yeah. Now, we may be getting a little bit too abstract in certain ways for some of our listeners that way. So let me go back to the idea that, for instance, that telepathy, as demonstrated in the laboratory, provides an analog for prayer. Well, take a little bit further. What's the idea of a spiritual being? Some sort of non-physical being? What does non-physical mean? It's certainly not what we think of as an ordinary physical person, and the idea seems nonsensical offhand. But on the other hand, we know from laboratory studies that the mind can not only reach out to another mind occasionally in a telepathic sort of way, but can actually reach out to the physical world, the clairvoyance studies, where the target is not something anyone else knows at the time, but is only the physical state of matter somewhere. That works just as well as telepathy in the laboratory, strangely enough. It's not as if a mind adds something. Well, now we've got a human mind that can sometimes reach out to other minds and can sometimes reach out directly to know the state of the physical world. That's a really interesting mind. That's something that's beginning to sound spiritual, if I may use that word. Now, the reason I'm stressing this, okay, is my larger identity is a transpersonal psychologist interested in spirituality and its effects on people and the like. But we have a tremendous problem nowadays. I think people are inherently spiritual. That's the nature of being a human being.
I agree with that.
But we also want to be accepted and smart and sensible and all that. And if science appears to say all spirituality is nonsense, it tremendously inhibits our access to and development of our own spirituality. So I think it's really important for people who live in these times and who have this negative inhibiting effect from mainstream science to realize that using the best kind of science in parapsychology, we actually have excellent evidence that the mind is a lot more than just the physical brain and body, and it sounds like something spiritual. You know, it kind of gives us a justification, being the kind of people we are, to take spirituality more seriously.
Many of us, though, trust our own experience and don't need science to give it a stamp of approval. We just assume science will one day catch up. But science is already making those inroads. What are those experiments that demonstrate telepathy and that demonstrate that mind over matter effect? And were you setting some of these up at SRI and some of the other institutes you worked at?
Yeah, the basic telepathy experiment is essentially you separate two people so there can't be any known way of physical communication. And then you give one of them some kind of target material to try to mentally send to the other and write down what the other person says or draws. Then you need some objective way of judging it, okay? I mean, you can get sloppy about this and it doesn't mean anything, you know, like I love to do pseudo-psychic readings where I'll say, Laura Lee, we've never met, but I can tell you're a very intelligent person. Is that right?
The person's going to say, well, of course I am.
Yes. Yeah. And I can also see that you have had difficulties at times with members of the opposite sex, but you've
like
gotten
who hasn't.
Over the hurt.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to judge these things more precisely if you want laboratory proof, and that's been done.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you have people sending the order of a deck of cards, old classical experiment, for instance, we know how many you'll get right just by guessing. And if somebody consistently gets more than that, we can objectively say there's something else happening here.
Do you find that the more someone exercises their telepathic abilities or their psi abilities, it's like a muscle, the better they get at it because they're learning to differentiate? It's standard operating equipment for the human body and mind, but we just have to use it to become more familiar with it?
Not necessarily. And in fact, in the early experiments where they did lots of card guessing things, people got worse with practice.
Interesting.
I figured that out as being due to psychological principles later on. You know,
okay, what
like,
principles?
Like, for instance, I could ask you now to put your raise your hand without looking and touch the exact middle of the back of your head, and I don't think you have any trouble doing it because you've had years of practice of coordinating your hand motions with your mental representation of where things are, and that's a minor variation. But if I say, read my mind, I think an intelligent response might be something like, huh? Do what? Which muscle do I flex? I think we have to learn how to use psychic abilities, not just do them. And to learn, you have to give people feedback. I did studies on this at UC Davis years ago, where I provided people with immediate feedback as to whether they were right or wrong, so they could start doing that very thing you mentioned, start making little discriminations, you know? Like, when I feel such and such a way, I'm always wrong. So from now on, if I have to try to use it and I feel that way, maybe I shouldn't even try. Wait till it goes away or try to change my mood.
When I feel another way,
I'm right part of the time. Let me see if I can develop that. And I had some interesting evidence that that looks like a possible way to develop psychic abilities, but I didn't have the research funds to really do that research as much as I would like. That's one of the frustrations in my life, okay? This theory I have for teaching ESP ability, I don't know whether it's the great breakthrough or a plausible-sounding idea that's not really true.
Right, because what sounds intuitive may prove to be, or what sounds counterintuitive may prove to be the solutions. You don't know until you test it.
And what works for one person may not work for another.
Yep.
So, for instance, in general, people do better when they're relaxed, but some people do best when they're challenged and they're kind of tense about it.
Well, you've listed some of the weird, so-called weird stuff that has merit and worthy of investigation that you have investigated. Where do you draw the line? What about the weird stuff that even you can't look at it and say, there's something here, it's just flaky, I'm sorry, you pushed my buttons too far.
Well,
we all get to that stage at some point. We all need that discrimination ability, too.
Yeah, let's take an example of pyramid power. Remember pyramid power?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that was so popular a while back. You know that if you put meat under a pyramid, for some mysterious psychic reasons, the meat wouldn't spoil as fast, and razor blades got sharper instead of duller if they were kept in a pyramid and all that. I was really interested when that came along, because I figured, you know, psychic functioning is ordinarily so unreliable that any kind of device that would increase it would be wonderful.
Yeah.
So, what about pyramids? Well, there were a lot of enthusiastic reports, and then some people started to do some careful experiments, and they found a couple of things. One of them was what was called the cookie jar effect. Any food put in a closed container will spoil a lot more slowly than any food out in the open. Had
right,
nothing to do with the shape of the container.
Fewer airborne spores and mold and bacteria getting at it,
yeah. And as far as the razor blade sharpening went, it turned out that judging the sharpness of a razor blade is very subjective.
Ah.
And people were just feeling it that way. But when they actually took microscopic photographs of the edge of the blade to count the number of nicks, which is what really contributes to the feeling of dullness or sharpness, having something in a pyramid-shaped container didn't work. Now, I was very disappointed in one way. It sounded like a really neat idea. But on the other hand, you know, I'm looking for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the truth is what's going to help us in the long run.
Yep. Now, what do you do when you're confronted by stuff that seems just utterly flaky? For example, breatharians. I've been hearing a lot about breatharians lately. People say, I don't need to eat food. I am just so full of enlightenment and consciousness that my body doesn't require food anymore. And I'm going, gee, wouldn't that be nice?
Well, I heard a wonderfully spiritually inspired talk by a prominent breatharian just earlier this, or late last week.
So you go, you check all these things out, don't you?
Well, it was in conjunction with some other stuff that I wanted to hear. It was part of the same program. I might not have gone on my own because I think the a priori likelihood of that being true is pretty low. But I'm not totally closed-minded.
Okay.
Well, I liked the lady. I liked to hear her talk. And she talked about how it's the spirituality that really matters and the getting by without food is just a carrot to attract people. And I thought, that's fine, but is it a carrot or a lemon? Okay, I want to see experiments where people like this are under 24-hour-a-day surveillance for several weeks at a time, and you can show that they don't actually eat anything and their health stays up. I will be very impressed if I see that kind of evidence. Meanwhile, the spirituality sounds great, but I don't know whether it's a carrot or a lemon. So I say, you know, I'm a person. I've got my boggle thresholds. I've got my biases.
Well, we need. You wrote a whole book about open mind yet discriminating mind. So.
And I also realize I can't be open-minded and knowledgeable about everything.
Yep.
You know, so for instance, sometimes people ask me to comment about UFOs, and I tell them, well, look, I'm a layman when it comes to UFOs. You know, mm-hmm. I've read some of the books. I think it's interesting, and probably something is happening, and also a lot of craziness is mixed in. But I have no expert status there, so I'm not going to give any opinion on it.
Mm-hmm. So it's good to know your own boundaries there. So, states of consciousness. It's so normal for us to go into various altered states of consciousness, and through the millennia, you can see how various human cultures utilized natural means to alter their states of consciousness. I mean, after all, we're curious, and we're tourists of the universe in mm-hmm. every way that we can be. What have you found out? I mean, you made a whole map of the mind and how various states of consciousness happen and why and what it means in terms of possibilities.
You know, back in 1969, I published my book, Altered States of Consciousness, which brought together all the scattered scientific information about altered states like hypnosis and meditation and dreams and the like. And it had a wonderful impact of opening up a lot of people to think about it both in a personal, practical way and in a research sort of way.
Yeah.
And then I've thought about it in terms of, you know, trying to get a general understanding of the mind. And I'm fascinated by altered states. Because it's quite clear to me that this is where I've come back to as the most interesting place. The strangest state of consciousness I know of is our so-called ordinary state. The one we take for granted because we're in it all the time.
Yeah.
And I've come to realize, for instance, that it's a construction or a fabrication. It's not natural. It's been built up in the process of being enculturated and being taught certain ways to think, to perceive, to feel. And it's semi-arbitrary. That is, you know, it's partly in accordance with reality, okay? If you're still alive, you know not to step in front of cars when you cross the street and things like that. But once you get into more subtle areas of life, like social relationships, there's enormous variation in how people's minds are constructed, especially from culture to culture. And we just take it for granted. Now, that's a problem, because if you take it for granted, you don't know that it might not be the right tool to use. Okay, I like in any state of consciousness as a tool. And any tool is good for some kinds of things and bad for other kinds of things, you know. A screwdriver is great for unscrewing things, but it's lousy for sawing through wood. If we really understood altered states and what their advantages and disadvantages were and how to shift from one to the other, you could adjust your state of consciousness to the situation you were in.
Mm-hmm.
The state of consciousness for going to church, for instance, is probably not the good state of consciousness for balancing your checkbook and vice versa. But we're a long way from really practically being able to apply this very well. I mean, some people have some natural talent for it, but there's an awful lot we don't know.
So are you suggesting that there's not one way to be wired, that genetics plays a role, but so does our environment and our culture and our education and just the own memes that we put in front of us?
To use a computer analogy, you know, your computer comes from the factory with an operating system, but then you decide what programs you're going to put on it, which determines how it runs.
Yep.
The pernicious thing about assuming that our ordinary state is natural is that it blinds you to the possibility of alternatives. You know, there are problems that are not solvable from particular states of consciousness. You just go around and suffer and chase your own tail and whatnot. If you could get into an altered state of consciousness, it's fine. So, for instance, being in love is clearly an altered state of consciousness.
Oh, that is, yeah.
That's a big one. And the way you perceive the world and what makes sense to you in that is very different from a cold, rational state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Both of them have their uses. But if you're stuck in any one state of consciousness, you're in trouble.
Do you believe that the big attraction to drugs in our culture is because our society doesn't allow or make room for other means of achieving altered states as they have done in indigenous cultures?
Yeah, that's part of it, okay? I mean, I was around when psychedelic drugs came into the culture and saw the whole process, both for myself and for other people. And that was one thing. We were dissatisfied with our ordinary state of consciousness and didn't know what to do about it. We were also dissatisfied with our religion. You know, our Judeo-Christian heritage is big on telling us you better be good or else.
Mm-hmm.
But not very good on how to be good, how to live the good life, how to understand spiritual truths for yourself.
Or experience spiritual truths.
Yeah. So for a lot of people, the experience that psychedelic drugs offered gave them insights into spiritual realities that were really important for their lives. And of course, you know, things got out of hand and went kind of crazy too, but that's human life.
Yeah. Well, why are we spending so many billions of dollars on this war on drugs? Couldn't that money be spent better elsewhere?
Insanity to me. I'm not going to justify it. You know, I mean, there are some drugs that have a fairly high abuse potential, like alcohol and nicotine.
Well, I don't see those being illegal.
No, you don't see them being illegal because too many people in the power structure are involved with those sorts of things. Education would be the right way to go, especially honest education. I've just added a link to my website, for instance, to a site called Ask Dr. Shulgin. Sasha Shulgin, Alexander Shulgin, is a chemist who invented quite a few psychedelic drugs. And he's not an establishment person. This is a website where people can get honest answers to some drug questions instead of it's all bad, run, 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 and then people try something and don't see anything obviously bad and then don't believe any information.
Well, what if some of that money was spent, maybe not by the government because that's not the government's role, but by other institutions to allow safe space to have altered states of consciousness through meditation or yoga or dreams or... there's so many other ways of, drumming.
Right.
You name the ways.
What are
the ways to have altered states of consciousness? Or you daydream, or you go take a shower, or you're driving a car, or even watching television can put you in a hypnagogic state.
Right.
I walked down the street when there was bright sunlight filtering through trees, and it was like a strobe effect, and I was just almost out of body one afternoon. So there's so many ways. We're so primed to go.
That's why I'm a transpersonal psychologist, though. You could call it spiritual psychology, but too many people freak at the word spiritual.
Oh.
But how do you get people to have some direct experience of this area we call spiritual? Not hear about it, not talk about it, but induce altered states where they know some of these truths for themselves. Developing that in a practical way that works for various people is really important.
Yep.
And that works for various people is important. Again, what is a great technique for one person will have nothing for another person.
That's why we have a whole menu, and it's a self-serve situation.
Yeah. I've seen people, for instance, who get 5 minutes of meditation instruction, sit down and have a mystical experience within 10 minutes.
Wow.
And I've seen other people like me who spent years sitting down and getting nothing but a sore back. That's why I wrote my latest book on meditation, that Mind Science book, because I'm a tough nut to crack.
Mm.
And after years and years of practice, I finally figured out ways for it to work for people like me and wanted to share that information.
Share. What have you found out?
Well, I found, for instance, that I've got to lower my standards. If I sit down and think, well, I ought to get into a state of no thought and God should be talking to me within 10 minutes, I'll be bound to have a failure experience and feel bad about the whole thing. But if I realize that it's going to take time, that if I can slow my thoughts some and not worry about where they absolutely stop, I'm going to make some advances that way.
Well, this typical meditation technique where you induce a mantra, for example, and Herbert Benson has written volumes about this, and then let the mind do what it does, and then when you realize, oops, I'm not saying that mantra, then reintroduce it. How does that work? What's actually happening?
Well, mantra is a very interesting technique. One of the meditation teachers I've studied with is Sogyal Rinpoche, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. He wrote that best-selling book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, very inspiring guy. And in the Tibetan tradition, they use a lot of mantras, including very fancy kind of mantras to repeat. And I've seen people say, oh, mantras, that's weird. I don't want to repeat something over and over to myself. You know, what is all that? And he has a wonderful way of kidding people and say, no, wait, you're already a very dedicated practitioner of mantra. All day long, you say things to yourself like, oh, I've screwed up again, I'll never get it right. Oh, I've screwed up again, I'll never get it right. Oh, I've screwed up again, I'll never get it right. I'm just going to teach you to change the content. So as a very basic level, one of the things mantras do is keep you from keeping your habitual patterns of thought and feeling going. And just by keeping that thing from going, new things can arise.
Yeah.
Remember I said earlier that our ordinary state that we take for granted is a construction?
Yeah.
We're working hard all the time to maintain this ordinary state of consciousness. And we're so used to it, we don't know we're working at it.
It's only a matter of letting go that really works, doesn't
it? It's only when you finally experience something like moments of meditative quiet that you can see how incredibly busy our ordinary state is. We're not just here, we're working.
Do you think it has always been so, or did previous cultures allow more of a state of being, like, for example, the Australian Aborigines or the hunter-gatherers of the earliest days? What do you think their daily...
Certainly some other cultures have allowed a lot more altered states of consciousness in useful kinds of ways. But our culture has not been very good on that, to put it mildly.
What's our hang-up? Why do you suppose that is?
Well, one of it is arrogance and success. You know, in ordinary consciousness, we've been able to beat the pants off all the other cultures in the world.
Certainly to dominate them.
It must have something good going for it. That's certainly one way people think about it.
Yeah.
And second is, once you have some degree of success in any particular endeavor in life, you tend to get fixated there, and you're loath to want to try anything else and suspicious of it, you know?
Uh-huh.
If I stop doing what's gotten me through life so far, what might happen? Better the devil I know than the unknown.
I think you hit it right there.
And, of course, we do have the example of craziness, okay? Some people that we label as crazy are in altered states of consciousness, and they're not using them very constructively. We can see you can suffer a lot through this sort of thing. So we're naturally very cautious about it.
Hear angry voices, we call it schizophrenia. Hear benevolent voices, and we call you a mystic. Yeah,
except a lot of people still call it schizophrenia. There's still a lot of bias and prejudice against that.
Yep.
Which is a shame, because it cuts people off from spiritual experiences.
Now,
when people tell me they hear voices, I say, that's nice. Are they interesting conversationalists? instead of get hung up on, oh, this is so exotic. You know, what does it have to say, you know?
Is it useful?
if you look at spiritualism, for instance, and some of the guides that purport to come through mediums, some of them are very interesting people to talk to, and others, if they were ordinary people, you wouldn't spend 5 minutes with them. They've got nothing to say but platitudes and dull things.
How do you explain channeling? What do you think's really going on?
Well, I don't have a universal explanation, because it's probably different in different cases, okay? In some cases, it's the person's own unconscious mind doing something. Maybe in a lot of cases. Whether that's wise or banal, that's a matter of how it works for the individual.
Right.
In some cases, it might be open to something more, but that's very hard to research. You know, if somebody says, you know, I was never incarnated on this planet, how are you going to check whether they're real or not? You can't. All you can do in that case is say, does what they say make sense? Are this a wise person to talk to?
Kind of outside the realms of scientific inquiry, some of this stuff. We're talking with Dr. Charles Tart, and a longtime researcher into states of consciousness. We'll continue our conversation just after this. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We're talking with Dr. Charles Tart. I wanted to ask you, speaking of the difficulty of admitting when you have spiritual experiences and voices don't accompany most of them, but you have created a safe haven on one of your websites, we have links to them, for scientists who have mystical experiences to talk about them.
Yes.
Tell us about that project.
Oh, that's a really interesting project to me. I call it TASTE, for its abbreviation, the Archives of Scientists' Transcendent Experiences. Not that only scientists have transcendent experiences. In fact, our cultural stereotype is that scientists would never have experiences like this. I'm out to destroy that stereotype. But I have to do it in a way that protects the scientists. See, for most scientists, if they admit to their colleagues that they've had some kind of psychic or spiritual experience, they'll be laughed at, and there may be real-world unpleasant consequences, like losing a job or something like that.
Or their funding for their newest project.
Newest project, right. So,
or their tenure at the university,
Yeah, they can be anonymous if they wish to, although half the people I've got on there so far have been used their real name. I've had 100,000 visits to it now. I've got about 75 scientists who've talked about various stuff, from what I call garden variety psychic experiences to quite profound mystical experiences. And I'm very inspired by it. I'm out to destroy that stereotype that scientists are not spiritual people. And also, I'm trying to use the cultural prejudices. You know, I only post experiences from people who are scientists in a conventional sense. And people say, why are you limiting it? Well, aside from practical things, Our cultural prejudice is that we give more attention to a physicist than to a plumber. Okay, so if you think a physicist's conversation with God is more profound than a plumber's, I'll get some physicists to talk about their conversations with God and try to up our awareness of spiritual things in general.
When you think of it, though, that's kind of a silly prejudice. It's
it
like
is
you're
a silly
saying,
prejudice.
I'm not an expert on UFOs, therefore don't expect me to be the end-all and be-all. Mystical experiences are rather democratic. We all have them.
Yeah, it's a silly prejudice, and I didn't invent it, but I figure I'll use it. And there is a positive side, too. Scientists are trained to try to be careful in the way they describe things, to not elaborate, to not confuse speculation with what actually happened and so forth.
Which is why a policeman reporting a UFO sighting might have more credibility than
That's
a
right.
teenager, for example. Okay.
That's right, yes.
Okay.
And, you know, scientists are one of my main communities also. Incidentally, we've talked a lot of science here, but I don't want people to get the impression, you know, that you can't live a spiritual life until science blesses it. I mean, I think it's important that we build bridges between the scientific and the spiritual and help to sort out what works and doesn't, what's inherently nonsensical and what may be true. But we can't wait on that to actually live our spiritual lives.
But doesn't,
we have to get on with it.
Doesn't science have innate limitations on what it can weigh in on opinions on the human soul? You can't see it squiggle under the microscope. Therefore, what can science really tell you about it? And if you're waiting for science to put its good housekeeping seal of approval on an issue, suppose that it's years in coming and you're missing out on trusting your own experience and trusting some interesting inroads because you're waiting. You know, the not trusting oneself is so disempowering.
That's a very practical thing. You've also raised an important point. What most people think of as science, what most scientists think of as science, is not science, it's scientism. Okay? Scientism is a word sociologists invented 60 years ago when they noticed that for a lot of people, including scientists, science, instead of being an open-ended search for truth, had become a closed belief system.
Propaganda.
Yeah. Well, it's like at some point you say, well, we know everything important in the world, and knowing everything important in the world, we can rule out everything else. And that's a hardening of the mental arteries. So what we popularly think of as science dismissing spiritual and psychic experience, that's actually scientism. Mm-hmm. That's a view, for instance, that says only what's material is real. Well, that's a philosophy. That's
but don't
science,
we have quantum
philosophy.
Don't we have quantum physics to tell us that what is real isn't always physical and obvious to our eyes?
That's starting to be a breakthrough, but that's not the view of science that actually animates most people in the science. Quantum physicists are still a small group. I mean, I'm glad they're there showing that things are not as solid as we think they are.
Mm.
But at the moment, we have to deal with spiritual and psychic things on their own level. We can't wait around for quantum physicists to explain it. And we don't know that they'll actually explain it. It might turn out they go off in another direction.
But they gave us an important insight, which we already knew, which is that all of this stuff that's happening in our minds isn't just figments of our imagination, that there's something real to this when we're picking up telepathic messages, for example. You've demonstrated in the laboratory that can be true. It can be a figment of your imagination, but maybe there is some sort of transmission.
Most quantum physicists would not agree with that statement, Laura Lee.
Ah.
A very few, and some of the popularizers. Okay, most of what we know is from popularizers who are interpreting quantum physics.
Okay,
but
that's
very few quantum physicists would say we have telepathy. They'd say we have action at a distance, and it's sort of spooky, and maybe it's a little like telepathy. And maybe we can explain that away so this weird stuff will go away.
Uh-huh.
We can't put our spiritual life on hold till science proves it. But when science can help us discriminate, and that's very useful.
What are some of those cases?
For instance, scientific research has shown that various kinds of meditation have good effects on physical health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a real plus. Now, that's only a part of what meditation is about, right? If the only reason you meditate is to lower your blood pressure or something, that's fine as far as it goes, but it's intended to do things a little more profound than just lower your blood pressure.
Right, to give you a spiritual path.
Right.
Or to at least illuminate your spiritual path a little more.
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, where have we gone in 40 years? Acceptance has increased. Some scientific validation has made some inroads into this whole field. What for you over the last several decades has been some of the most important things that have been put on the table solidly and firmly? What has been hinted at? What has been the most surprising breakthroughs for you in this whole field, Charles?
Well, I think, for instance, there's no reasonable doubt that four basic psychic phenomena are real. And that's telepathy, or mind-to-mind communication, clairvoyance, where the mind can pick up information about the physical world, precognition, where sometimes the mind can predict the future when it's inherently unpredictable, and psychokinesis, where simply wishing for something can directly affect the physical world. And we can throw in a fifth of psychic healing, which might or might not be a form of psychokinesis.
Mm-hmm.
To me, those are solid things that we're quite sure about. Now, there are other things I'm not quite so sure about yet. So, for instance, out-of-the-body experiences, reincarnation, post-mortem survival, there's some interesting evidence in favor of them, but they haven't been investigated all that much. You know, those are where some of the frontiers are. I run a discussion group, for instance, by people who are interested in the question of surviving death. Only one of our members is actually able to do much research because you can't get any money to research something like this. But, you know, I have this funny idea that the question of whether we actually survive death or not is more important than curing the common cold. But I seem to be at odds with the culture in terms of research support.
Uh-huh, and where those dollars should be spent. So what has been some of the validating experiments going on, for example, psychokinesis?
The old psychokinesis model, the classical model for doing it, started when a gambler walked into J.B. Ryan's laboratory at Duke University, it must be 60 years ago now, and said something like, "Doc, I shoot craps for a living, and I make a good living, but I'm honest, I don't have loaded dice or anything, but I just read this statistics book and found out I can't make this good a living. What's happening?" So there were many experiments where they basically had machines throw dice while somebody wished for certain faces to come up. And it's a small effect, but you kept getting more of the desired faces coming up. Now, that's really old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
The big trend in research the last 30 years or so has been you don't throw anything physical like dice. You have electronic machines, sort of like computers, that simulate random generations of ones and zeros or something like that. Well, people will them to, say, come up with more ones for the next minute than zeros or something. And it works a fair amount of the time. Now, to me, that's actually mind-blowing, you know, because if somebody asks you to influence the throw of dice, you see them being thrown down on the table and all that, you can kind of imagine your mind giving a die a little push at a certain time to make the desired face come up.
But when it's a random rolling of a machine.
Yeah, what do you push on? Which transistor, which chip do you put a twist in? Or what do you do? It's paraconceptual, you know, and yet people can affect these things. You know, instead of 50-50, they can get them up to 51-49 or 52-48, something like that.
So it's a tiny effect, but say when you're gambling and you go through many different hands, that tiny bit can increase your odds to make you a winner?
Not enough at the casinos. The house's edge is a little bit thinner.
I see.
A little bit
stronger. So you're just
kind of
evening the odds,
kind of.
Yeah.
But in principle, we ought to be able to improve this ability to come up to something practical.
Then how was this gambler making out? Was he just exceptionally good at this?
I think Ryan tested him and found, you know, that he came up with more than would be expected by chance. But that was the early days. They threw dice in cups, for instance, and who knows what funny things you could do. That's why they invented machines to
throw. Good that same man would do with that electronic spinning machine.
Well, that was a long time ago before the machines.
Right,
but
so the question is,
more interesting things have happened since then. For instance, I think one of the most interesting experiments has been the remote viewing experiments. I was a consultant on the Stanford Research Institute remote viewing experiments, and they're really quite fascinating. You basically tell someone, this person you met has just gone to some place selected at random and is hiding there. Tell me what the place looks like. And you copy down whatever any drawings they make, record anything they say, and then to get rid of the subjectivity in it, you know, you've had trouble with the opposite sex kind of stuff, you collect a series of these things and have a blind judge judge them. That is, the judge gets a list of, here's nine places that were used as target locations. Here's nine sets of descriptions. We're not telling you what description's supposed to be about what place. You go out and match them. You know, if all the person is saying is, well, it's kind of blue up above and solid below, that'll fit in your location.
That's pretty vague. Yeah.
To successfully do remote viewing, you have to say specific, correct things about a place that don't apply to every place in general. And this experiment has worked very well. Some of this was eventually funded by the Army, the CIA, and the like. You know, they'll deny that they really got much results out of it, but the results were really very good. Remote viewing showed practical applications at times. It was consistently good with a lot of people.
What are the experiments that have looked at precognition, and then what does that say about the nature of time?
Oh, boy, I'm going to skip the second part because it blows my mind when I try to think about time. Okay, it's a small-scale effect, but basically the classical experiment is something like you tell a person, an hour after you leave here, I'm going to have this machine shuffle this deck of cards 100 times. Would you please write down now what the order of the deck of cards would be?
Uh-huh.
A simple request, but quite mind-blowing when you think about it. But it works. You know, again, not every experiment succeeds, and it's a small-scale sort of effect that people get more than they should by chance. It is a real reminder to me of how limited my understanding of the universe is if somebody can reach ahead into a future that's inherently mm-hmm. unpredictable like that.
Those are very abstract and really not emotionally clicking to someone. However, most people, myself included, have had moments of precognition or clairvoyance.
Sure.
When there's a really meaningful communication, it's almost as though those beings you talked about, those non-physical beings, are sitting there sending you a message in order to help you deal with an insight or deal with a situation coming up ahead of time.
Let me give you a practical example of that done by a parapsychologist named Ed Cox quite a few years ago.
Okay.
He collected a lot of statistics on train wrecks. You know, how many people were injured, how many people were killed and all that. And then he discovered something quite interesting. Compared to other days of the week when there weren't wrecks, there were significantly fewer numbers of passengers on those trains.
Interesting.
Now, that tells you that some people suddenly said, I don't think I'll take that trip today, something like that. I'd love to see something comparable for the airlines, but I don't think airlines like to give out statistics on accidents.
They're pretty guarded with
all that. Public relations.
They don't even tell you when a plane's late, will they?
Sure. It can work practically, you know, and I've talked to many people, you know, who suddenly had this feeling of don't do something, and sure mm-hmm. enough, there's been an accident or something.
Yep.
Now, that is also nice and mind-blowing, too, because, of course, their precognition that they would die if they did a certain thing is wrong because they didn't do it and they didn't die. Does that mean there are multiple futures and they saw one in which they did it and they died, so they just moved into a different future? Does it mean the future is there but can be changed? When I feel too arrogant about how much I know, I think about precognition, and that always grounds me very effectively.
Do you enjoy science fiction where they try to take some of these scenarios and play them out and do a lot of what-ifs?
Oh, yeah. I used to read a lot of science fiction. It's a good mind stretcher.
Yep. What are some of the experiments that have been done for clairvoyance?
Well, the most interesting one that I know of is the... And this is kind of a fun thing. Some people have said they don't believe in clairvoyance because they can't see how information can go from a distant location in the physical world into your brain. But they've come up with an alternative explanation to explain the clairvoyance results away. They said, in the future, when you find out what the target actually was, that information enters your brain by ordinary sensory channels. So when you thought you were doing clairvoyance in the past, what you were really doing was precognizing the future state of your own brain. So you didn't have to cross any space, just time. Now, if that sounds weird,
whichever.
It sure does sound weird, but for some people who are interested in quantum physics, that seemed much more probable than the clairvoyance. So Russell Targ and I actually did an experiment to test that. We said, okay, can information actually cross space in real time? And let's eliminate the possibility that you know the future state of your own brain. So we had people do some clairvoyance tests with a computer that generated targets inside the machine. So they were never known to anybody. It was just the internal state of the machine.
So they weren't picking up any telepathic
messages.
That's
right. And it kept track of your overall score, but then erased all the information except the overall score. So nobody in the future could ever know the state of those things, eliminating any possible future telepathy.
Clever.
And we got some interesting results suggesting, yeah, there's such a thing as pure clairvoyance.
Interesting. Clairvoyance is seeing, but what about clairaudience, hearing?
Oh, yeah.
And so, are you putting that all in the same package here?
It can happen in any of the sense modalities. You know, some people have had strange smells appear which told them about distant things or feelings of touches and the like.
Yeah.
We talk about clairvoyance simply because we're creatures who spend most of our time seeing, so that's our way of talking about it.
If someone heard those voices, would that be clairaudience?
Yeah, that's the term for it.
You yourself, now, do you have any of these para abilities, these psychic or
I've
psi
had
abilities?
Occasional spontaneous psychic experiences, but, you know, I don't think of myself as especially psychic. I've just noted them.
Why are you so interested in this? How did you get interested in all this?
Well, I wish I had a dramatic story, you know, where suddenly God appeared and said, young man, you should study parapsychology, but it didn't work that way. It
rarely does.
Mine was a more gradual thing, but actually it's an interesting story because I think it'll touch something in a lot of listeners. I was raised conventionally religious. I was brought up as a Lutheran, you know. My grandmother took me. I believed everything. I was very devout in a sense. And then by the time I got to my teenage years, I was thinking for myself. I was learning about science. I saw that a lot of what I believed was rejected by the science of the times as nonsensical. You know, and I saw the hypocrisy in people who were religious and all that. So I got into a big conflict between my scientific beliefs and my religion, which I think a lot of people do. Now, looking back over the years, I can see there's several classical paths for how people resolve that.
Okay.
Some people sort of go all the way toward materialistic science and say, right, all that religion is nonsense and reject it. Which I think is kind of an extreme reaction. Other people go all the way in the opposite direction and say, no, what it says in my holy book is the absolute truth, and the scientists are devils, and I won't think about them.
Okay, those are the two extremes.
That's pretty silly, because it's kind of hard to ignore science. Mm-hmm. And some people sort of compartmentalize it, right? They'll think about religion for an hour on Sunday and not think about it for the rest of the week. I was very lucky, because at that time I was a voracious reader, and I stumbled onto the old psychical research and the modern parapsychology literature, and realized this science-religion conflict had been experienced by many intelligent people in the past, and they'd come up with this brilliant idea. They said, okay, of course there's some nonsense in religion, but is it all nonsense? Well, let's take the scientific method, this quest for the truth, which doesn't mean things are only physical, and apply it to this area of religion and spiritual and psychic things, and see if we can start separating out the wheat from the chaff. And that's how psychical research and parapsychology was born. And that's what I've been doing ever since, basically. I've been saying, you know, let's take open-minded scientific method and apply it to the psychic and the consciousness and the like, and see what makes sense that way, and see what doesn't make sense, and can we get a better idea of what reality is and how to use it.
Was that part of your argument to get the funding that you did when you were at SRI and some of these other places to do the experiments you did?
I'd never give that argument to a granting agency.
What justification do you have for this?
Now, I didn't have to get the funding at SRI, but I've gotten funding when I was at UC Davis and the like. And there you pitch stuff in a much more scientific manner. And most conventional granting agencies won't give you any money, no matter how scientifically you pitch it. The money usually comes from private individuals who are interested in some aspect of it.
Right. And so they're saying...
And it's not much money, believe me. I did a survey of all the scientific parapsychology labs in the United States and Canada one year, as well as Europe. And because they all know me and trust me, they would tell me how much money they got. I found all the laboratories in the country... their total budget was less than $500,000 a year for all the labs.
My gosh.
Now, by industrial standards at that time, that was worth two scientists time you threw in the support staff.
Yeah.
It's no wonder we've progressed very, very slowly, because there's basically no money compared to the complexity of the problem.
It's not like
we have hundreds of really smart people thinking about it and doing research and all that. It's a few people, mostly part-time. Uh-huh. I'm only part-time myself.
If you were sitting there and with a lot of funding and you wanted to assign various scientists or grant their requests for different projects, what would you like to see happen out there if you could remedy the situation?
Oh, I have lots of things I'd like to do. I'd like to systematically study out-of-the-body experiences, for instance, like I was able to do on a pilot basis before. I'd like to find bright young people who are brilliant and who would like to enter the field but know it would ruin their career to try to, and fund them. Because, you know, us old farts, you know, we've been thinking the same way for a long time. We need some bright young blood in here who will think about it in a different way. There'd be no trouble funding a lot of very creative projects.
What would your criteria be?
Originality and rigor, okay? I don't want flaky people, because we don't need sloppy research in this field. Reality may be sloppy, what happens in everyday life, but if you're going to try to affect science, get other bright people thinking about it, you've got to use really rigorous things. And I'd like stuff that has some application to ordinary life. So like the study I did years ago of a woman who could have out-of-the-body experiences almost at will, that's an analog for studying the soul leaving the body.
Yep.
And I was able to find distinctive changes in her brain when she had these experiences in the laboratory, that she was able to do an extrasensory perception aspect of it. But I was incredibly lucky to find somebody who could do it at will like that, you know, because very expensive to put somebody in a sleep laboratory overnight. I'd love to comb the country for people who had that kind of talent, have several laboratories where they could be screened and find the people who really could do it at will. That would be really exciting. To measure what happens to a body when the soul is out of it, to use that kind of language.
For us non-scientists, and we want to progress in our own path, and we want to make the most of our time here in this environment, investigating these things on our own, what do you suggest? To keep a journal, to pay attention to your dreams,
to meditate? In the 1 minute we have left?
Sum it up for us. Yeah, what do you advise?
You know, I am primarily a transpersonal psychologist, and there's a lot I could advise, and a lot of it centers around the old axiom, know yourself. You know, we are very good at fooling ourselves and kidding ourselves. We also have enormous potentials, and we have to start understanding ourselves and where our hopes and fears distort what we're doing. You know, my mind science book, again, is about developing basic meditation as a tool where you can quiet your mind so it's not like a three-ring circus and begin to have insights into your fundamental nature instead of simply what people have told you you want to believe. I'll advise people to read the book because in the few seconds we have left, I know I can't possibly say more. But it's important to do, really important to do.
Makes life an interesting adventure as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. We have to find the truth for ourselves, not just let somebody else tell us what it is.
Where do you think we're going? Where do you think the next, and what are the, in terms of human potential?
Where we could go is understanding the human mind enough so that people would be able to change their state of consciousness to function more effectively, to have deeper insights into themselves and others,
yeah,
to be wiser and kinder and more compassionate people, and to develop a semi-scientific basis for a new kind of spirituality. See, the old traditional spiritualities were all developed for certain people and certain cultures and all that, and a lot of them don't work for modern people. We've got to find out what works. For instance, if somebody comes to me and says, what kind of spiritual path should I follow? I don't know. For most of the planet's history, the spiritual path you followed was the one spiritual path that was available in your country. There were no alternatives. Now we have lots of alternatives. But what works for people? You know, a Sufi path that is fantastic for one person may lead another person into a psychosis and bore another person to tears. How could we develop ways of studying what these different paths do for different kinds of people and be able to say, you should do a Buddhist meditation because that's effective for your type, but don't do Sufi dancing or something?
I think we realize that there's not one size fit all in this path, and that because of this new openness and respect for other cultures, and it's all so available to us, it's really for self-starters to figure it out. We have the ability to go from one thing to the one thing and to the one thing until we hit on the one that's working for us at that time, and to leave it when that no longer works and to get on to the next thing.
But we don't have infinite time, and that's why I'd like to be able to use scientific methods to develop guides to help people find the effective ones. When I think of my own career as attempting to be a meditator, for instance, I think I spent years spinning my wheels because I didn't get the right kind of instruction for me.
I see.
You know, and if I had gotten the right kind of instruction, things might have been very different a lot longer.
In raising your own children, did you encourage them to pay attention to their dreams, to pay attention to their intuition? Did you raise your children a bit differently?
Of course. So they had to rebel against it.
Oh, dear.
They had to rebel.
That really is true, huh?
But they're slowly coming around now.
Because one thing I hear lamenting is that, my parents just didn't it when I had these psychic abilities showing up. They just really hounded me and said this was wrong and all of this stuff. So I'm wondering,
that's one of the saddest things in this world, actually, when people are naturally psychic as children and their parents and their peers suppress it and ridicule them. That's a terrible kind of thing.
So we can understand that how we are is truly a gift, and there are ways and means, if you're open to experimenting and paying attention to yourself, of making the most of this opportunity, huh?
Yes.
Yes. Thanks so much.
Thank
Charles,
you,
really
Laura
appreciated the visit.
Fun.
Appreciated all your 40-plus years of investigation into consciousness and parapsychology. Appreciate your listening tonight. Thanks. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com.